A presenting sponsor of the Culinary Now podcast is Forge to Table Knives. Forge to Table was started by JWU alumnus Noah Rosen in the pursuit of the perfect knife company for chefs, home cooks, actually anyone who likes cooking. Check out their website at forgetotable.com or follow them on their social media at Forge to Table. They are making fantastic knives and other stuff. I always like to give a little shout out to my personal favorite of the week. I just got the new Forge to Table apron. It's got the Forge to Table logo on it. It's made by the brand Kaysen, which makes incredibly high quality aprons. Forge to Table partnered with Kaysen to make these awesome, awesome aprons. And so if you're looking for something that has incredibly great style, supports the brand and high quality, make sure you check out their aprons and pick one up for yourself. Forge to Table, as always, wants all the Culinary Now listeners to know, have a knife day. Welcome, everyone, to the Culinary Now podcast. I'm Matt Britt, and today I'm talking with Chef and Dr. Robert Brown, who is an associate professor here at Johnson & Wales University. And I'm talking to Dr. Brown specifically today because we're coming up to the Passover holiday, and not being of the Jewish faith myself, I feel like I'm not able to speak on this very well. So I wanted to bring in someone who had a lot more experience in talking about the Passover food traditions and really have a conversation about that. So Dr. Brown, thanks again for joining us and welcome to the pod.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So Dr., real fast, because I just kind of skimmed over your titles and what you do here, what your title is here at Johnson & Wales, but can you give us a little bit of history about sort of how, you know, you've come to be an educator here at the university?
Of course. So I come from a family. My father was a kosher, an owner of kosher and Jewish delicatessens in the Maryland and New York area, started in New York and then branched out to Maryland. My mother was an elementary school teacher and then principal, so the idea that I would go into culinary education made a lot of sense. Most of my career as a chef was in Jewish kosher facilities. I was the executive chef of the Kingsbrook Jewish Medical Center in New York City, Weinberg Village, the JCC in Tampa, Florida. I was also the executive chef, the corporate chef for the Cohen Foundation camps, which are summer camps, Jewish summer camps throughout the New England area. My career as a chef has been in kosher Jewish food. Then when I went into teaching, I started teaching high school level, junior college, community college, and moved all the way up to my current position here at Johnson & Wales University, where I teach a number of culinary academic courses.
Awesome. Awesome. So you're definitely qualified to talk about the Pesach holiday coming up. And you know, I wanted to specifically go at Passover because, you know, as a struggling Catholic myself, a Gentile, if you will, there's not really, I know we eat a lot of food at Easter, but I feel that the Passover holiday specifically has much more importance when it comes to what kind of food you eat and how you eat them, the order, and sort of the meal is more centered around the meaning behind the food, perhaps more than it is for the Easter holiday, at least in my family. So is it possible, just for those listening, to give like sort of a brief, you know, sort of history of why Passover is important and how it connects to food?
Sure. Well, I think first it's noteworthy to say that I think the Jewish faith, as opposed to other faiths, traditionally and historically have been more food-centric in general as a group of people. All of the main Jewish holidays, the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, even the Jewish Yom Kippur, the fasting day, you know, is atonement, and we atone by cutting off food. So I think food to Jews is more than just a central part. I think it's a germane part of the religion itself. So even just speaking religiously and secularly, food in general is more at the focus of every holiday we have. Passover especially, because Passover is a time where we use food to remember the afflictions that our ancestors went through. So the Jews were enslaved forever. It's part of being a Jew. And the fact that we were enslaved, we think back to this particular time in history, you know, before Christ, the time of Moses, where the Jews, it's Exodus. So if you talk about in the story of, let's just say for a second, biblically. So you have the Old Testament, the New Testament, and of course, Jews, practicing Jews, follow the Old Testament, the first five books of Moses. And Exodus, the story of Exodus, is the story of Passover. It's when Moses, who grew up, you know, ironically, the word Moses means drawn from the water. When he's a baby, the Pharaoh is, at that time, the Pharaoh has made an edict where he's going to kill all the firstborn Jews. He's going to try to eradicate the Jews off the planet for the, you know, the among throughout history, everyone's trying to eradicate the Jews from the planet. But this is his era. So he said he'll kill all the firstborn men, therefore there'll be no procreation. So Moses' mother wants to hide Moses, so she takes Moses and she puts him in a bassinet and she sends him down the river, the Nile. And ironically, he floats down the Nile and he gets picked up by the Pharaoh's daughter herself. She picks him up, takes him back to the castle, and Moses grows up as a member of the royal family, the same family which he's trying to leave persecution. And he grows up as a member, as a sort of a stepchild to the Pharaoh himself, and a brother to the upcoming Pharaoh. So when that happens, he realizes one day, later on in his life, that he's actually a Jew, and that he's known in the Jewish faith as the only human being to ever speak to God. Many people know the burning bush, and he sees this burning bush, and he has a conversation with God, and God says, "Hey, go back to the Pharaoh and let my people go." And he says, "Well, how can I do that?" And there's a whole story with that, and then eventually, he threatens, he gives him plagues. God is on his side. You know, God gives him the strength and the power to do so. And the Pharaoh eventually lets him go, lets the Jews go. And they wound up wandering in the desert for 40 years. And that's where the Passover tradition starts, you know, culinarily, with the essence of matzah, right? Matzah is an unleavened cracker bread that we eat on Passover exclusively, right? The whole idea of Passover is to get rid of all things bread, all things that rise. Symbolically, to talk about the fact that at the time, the sense of urgency, a term we use in culinary a lot, right? The idea of getting the hell out of Egypt was so fast that we didn't have time to make the bread rise. We had to eat these unleavened cracker matzah doughs. So as time has gone on, Jews throughout the history have celebrated the same time of year, eating matzah and bringing the tradition of unleavened bread foods into the culture to remember that time in history where we were persecuted.
So I think it's important to know, not that that's a very good sort of introduction to where the food conversation can start. I will say that your you know, saying "let my people go" was way better than Charlton Heston could have ever done. You know, and as someone,
well, he's not a Jew,
but someone who was forced to watch that movie, The Ten Commandments, every Easter for my entire life, I have both an appreciation for it and just a little bit of like hatred. But you did it very well.
Thank you.
So I think that when you talk about masa and how that plays such an important role, I do want to talk about some other things that, you know, again, play traditionally a very important role. And I think that, you know, one thing that we'll hopefully talk about a little bit more is that, you know, the tradition is alive and well, but there are a lot of people that are doing seders or Passover meals that go a little bit outside the box. And I want to definitely get into some of the opportunities and the possibilities of building out your seder to be a little bit more reflective of today's modern, you know, approach to cooking and accessibility to cooking and people's more interest in it. But if we can go back to the tradition, I mean, you mentioned masa, but I know that in a traditional seder, there's a plate and there's six things on that plate. So Maybe you can go through what the six things are. If you're going to go by the letter of the law, the traditional things you must serve at that Passover meal, the seder.
Sure. So I think to begin that conversation, it's important to understand that it's important to discern what must stay and what has room for evolution or change. So there's a lot of change since the time that I grew up. I grew up in a family that, when I was young, was an Orthodox Jewish family, as Orthodox as it gets. My grandfather made my mother feed me formula in the freezing cold outside on the steps because he wouldn't allow the formula in the house during Passover because the formula wasn't kosher for Passover. So that is the, just to give you an idea of the level of strict that we observe these holidays. We, in our family now, do nothing close to that. So we're a good example of who moved into modern day. However, there are aspects of the Seder that will never change in 100 years and were the same in the days back in Moses. And the Seder plate is one of those, right? So anything symbolic of the plight, anything that's symbolic of the Jewish plight of Exodus has to stay. So the Seder plate, so like many other religions, and it's really no difference between where Christmas has come, right? Because if you think about Christmas and Easter, those were traditionally, revolved around the life and death of Christ. And they've also moved away from other things to become more secular and more involving and more inclusive and all that kind of stuff too. So those parallels are pretty much there. But the Seder plate is a plate. It's a large plate. It's ornate. Some of us... it's the same thing with, remember that movie Raiders of the Lost Ark where they're looking for Jesus's cup and they look at all these beautiful cups. And of course, they really understand that Jesus was a carpenter and that his cup would be a very humble kind of cup, right? It's the same kind of thing here. You have some people who take the Seder to be very elaborate, use it as an opportunity to show their successes and things like that. And some people have some big, very golden Seder plates, but some people just have a plate with things on it. But the items on the Seder plate, again, are symbolic. So I'll just go on very quickly. So there's an egg, right? Egg, roasted egg is a very important part of Jewish faith. You eat eggs when people die. You eat eggs because eggs represent the world, the oval round world, the earth. The idea of that is always represented by the egg. And that's important too. Then there's what's called the karpas, which is the parsley, right? There are some herbs. So parsley is there to represent green, to represent the freshness, earth and green and God's gift of earth. There's also something called, there's the moror. The moror is horseradish. And the horseradish is on that plate to represent, horseradish is very, what's the word you want to use for it, Chef? It's
so. Am I wrong in horseradish? Like, and I mean, I've been to very few seders in my life, but it's like people eat it almost to like channel the suffering,
correct?
Like what the Jews went through and the slavery, and it's like, I mean, there are people that really go all in on that. They'll take huge bites, and like it's really meant to connect to that story that you told earlier.
Right. So there's a part in the seder where you're just supposed to eat matzah with horseradish only on it. And the idea is to get the pungency, to get the evil, quote, of the flavor of horseradish. You're supposed to feel the pain, however that is, right? So you're supposed to have something in your mouth that really reminds you of something you wouldn't want to necessarily eat, right? This is not like a horseradish sauce that's tempered by a sour cream and put on it's just straight horseradish. So that's there. Later on in the Seder, you make what's called the Hillel sandwich, which is matzah and horseradish with the addition of what's called choroseth. And choroseth is it's a chutney sort of, right? I'm just trying to put it, where it's made of crushed up walnuts, crushed up apples, and wine into this very thick paste. And what it's supposed to represent is the mortar that the Jews used when they were forced by hand to build the pyramids. So a part of this whole thing, remember, historically, and even forget about religiously, but historically through time, this was the time where Pharaoh had the Jews build those pyramids. When you see the three pyramids that represent Egypt and the Sphinx, those were built by Jews brick by brick, enslaved. So the mortar, the paste that put the bricks together is represented by this choroseth. And you're supposed to eat a sandwich of a little piece of matzah, some Moror, some horseradish, which represents the pain, but also with this, because remember, it's apples and honey and so it represents the paste of the mortar, but it's also a very sweet, delicious kind of thing. So again, it's that balance of understanding that while we're tasting the bitterness of the bitter herb, the horseradish, we're also combining that with the sweetness of life and how far we've come, which is a big part of the history of Passover in general. The idea that we're balancing the fact that we want to remember where we came from, but we also want to celebrate the fact that we have come a long way. So the other parts of the last couple of parts is of the plate. There's a shank bone. There's a bone, and that's a roasted bone representing the lamb, which is the Paschal lamb, which is, of course, Easter, right? Easter is the word Easter is the Paschal lamb also. So we can talk at some point, if you'd like, about the interconnection between Easter and Passover, which are very, very, very overlaid. But there's the bone, because remember, in retribution, God, whatever your belief in is God, God can be... He likes retribution. He likes to punish. So after the first death, after the Pharaoh called for the death of the firstborns, Moses came back and actually God said, now let's smite the firstborns of the Egyptians as the last straw. They weren't letting them go from Egypt. Moses said, locusts. The locusts came. The Pharaoh said, okay, let them go. Then when the locusts stopped, the Pharaoh said, hold it. They're not going. Okay, what about, drought? What about famine? So there were these different plagues, and none of them worked. And finally, the last one is God said, all right, we're going to smite all the firstborn of the Egyptians. Of course, the Pharaoh's firstborn was smitten. And therefore, the Pharaoh said, okay, you're not playing games, God, and let him go. So the idea that in order for the angel of death, the Machamuvitz, we call him, to make sure the angel of death passed the right homes and only smote the Egyptian children, not the Jews, Moses told the Jews, go outside tonight and put lamb's blood on your door with a paintbrush. And once you put lamb's blood, the angel of death will know that you're a Jewish home and he'll pass over your house. That's where Passover comes from. Passover comes from the angel of death passing over your house, the lamb's blood. So the lamb's blood, you don't get a lot of lamb's blood these days. So the lamb's blood is represented on the Seder plate as a shank bone. Most of us culinarily, because we make a turkey, we'll use the turkey neck. I'll use the turkey neck or something to represent that. And the last part of the Seder plate, which is important, is there's a bowl of salt water in the middle of the plate. And that represents the tears that were cried during slavery. And many times throughout the night, you're asked to dip the karpas, dip the greenery, the parsley into the tears. And again, eat salt water and parsley. So there's a lot of this dichotomy of feeling the suffering at the same time enjoying the progress.
I mean, it's very symbolic, and everything you just said really does sort of highlight, why the symbolism is important, and the story about how the sort of the wrath of God. I mean, the Old Testament God was much more vengeful than maybe the New Testament, and I think you see that a lot. But I think that, some of the things that you mentioned were on the Seder plate. They do make an appearance in Easter as well. I mean, eggs are very well associated with Easter, maybe not as traditionally or as symbolically. I mean, the Easter bunny, everyone always questions like, why is there a bunny associated with this holiday? And, in certain European traditions, the bunny is, again, sort of that wrath of God. It's someone who comes down and assesses children to see if they've been doing things right or doing things wrong. And I like that you pointed out the sort of circular nature or oval nature or continuous nature of the egg as sort of life, because I think that that's another reason or another opportunity to show why eggs are important. And people sometimes will question why eggs are there, but that really does sum it up very nice. And then the lamb, I mean, this weekend coming up for Easter, we're doing lamb because I think it does sort of find its way, among other things. There's Easter ham and there's Easter turkey, and some people will do beef. But like this year, we're doing a lamb as well because there are members of my family that are more religious. And I think that idea of the Lamb of God and stuff, it does sort of translate to that Easter plate as well. So, Easter is certainly a continuation of the Passover meal, but, I really do value the sort of the history and the tradition that you talked about to help, provide some context. So you mentioned earlier that, you know, your family now, not maybe when you were growing up, but now you do things a little bit different. Not necessarily that you're not paying homage to, you know, the traditions. You told me all the time that, you know, that whole week it's matzah for you 100%. What do you serve at your table for Passover that maybe does sort of bridge into, you know, the secular, more sort of gastronomic trends we see in today's, you know, Passover meals?
So that's an interesting question. So I will start that conversation. I'll answer that question beginning by saying not much has changed. I keep a very traditional holiday. That is a choice of mine because, number one is, remember, my entire history culinarily has been in historical Jewish food. So I have the chops, first of all, to be able to make all that product and everything as it used to be. But I think more, if you want to talk about the evolution of the Seder in terms of food, it's become more about inclusivity. It's become more about people's dietary needs and restrictions, right? Because that comes into the Seder plate too. It's become a lot about the children, you know, feeding them. So where have things changed? Well, first of all, the biggest change is in the restriction of kosher. So as we move forward with Jewish holidays from the time in the last 50 years, from the time I was a boy to now, the biggest change has been, you know, the relaxation of kosher laws and restrictions. So when I was a kid, everything was very strictly kosher. No mixing of meat, milk, certainly no shellfish, none of that. Like I said to you, my mother couldn't even bring milk into the house during Passover for everything, right? Despite the fact that she was asked in the freezing cold to sit outside and feed a newborn, and no one thought twice of it because that was just, it was, you know, the priority was the faith. But now it's more relaxed. So now, so the first thing is the kosher. The kosher is pretty much gone from my table. We don't use kosher meat because, first of all, it's 6 or 7 times more expensive, and that's the reality of today. So if I'm preparing a meal for 40 people and I'm making a roast, a kosher roast is going to cost a tremendous much more amount of money than an unkosher roast. So right now, we still stay relatively... We don't mix milk and meat, although that's not true because I'll serve at the end of the meal. At the Passover Seder is a very long process. It's 6 or 7 hours. It goes all into the night. And at the end of the dinner, I'll serve coffee, and the coffee will have cream for sure. And I'll even serve maybe butter pats, you know, with the matzah. So there's clearly the elimination of kosher or the relaxing kosher laws, and the cost is a part of that too. So that's the biggest thing. The second thing is the understanding of health and wellness and the understanding of food just being less dense and heavy. So Jewish food traditionally is very dense. We use a lot of schmaltz, which is a chicken fat, right? So when you break apart a chicken, right, you talk about culinary, you talk about cross-utilization, you know, we would take all the fat off the chicken and make the soup. Before we make the soup, we would spend forever trimming the chicken. And we take every piece of fat off of that chicken so that we have a nice lean bone soup. And then all that fat we throw into a pan, put an onion in the middle of the pan, and let it render, and just make like a pound or a pound and a half of schmaltz, chicken fat, this onion-flavored chicken fat. And that would be the fat that we would use throughout the entire thing. We'd use it cold, we'd use it warm. That would be the main fat instead of oil. Well, chicken fat, as you can imagine, is no longer, you know, doesn't have the presence in the food anymore. We've moved to vegetable oil, just like the world has moved from heavy butter and creams to more of a light sort of, you know, an understanding of better fats and less trans fats and all that kind of stuff. So that's another part of the difference. And the third one is gluten-free, veganism, some of the lifestyle choices that people have, either medically or because of their own lifestyles, that's made the way into the Seder too. So whereas, for example, the vegetable used to be always, you know, some sort of vegetable fritter or some sort of vegetable casserole, a lot of casseroles. Now we do roasted root vegetables, even though it's in the spring. But we do different colored carrots, and the vegetables themselves are now they're now indicative of the cooking methods, which have become all from cooking everything in fat and confit to grilling and broiling and being more conscious of cooking methodologies and what ingredients we use and less salt. I mean, Jewish food was filled with salt. So when you think about the difference between what it was and what it is, the Seder looks a lot the same. A lot of the foods are the same, but the way we produce them, the ingredients we use, and the attention to our guests have changed, just like the evolution of food in general.
I still can't believe, and again, I can believe it, but I can't believe it, that like your mother had to feed a baby in the cold. I can just imagine that if I told my wife to go outside and feed our child in the cold,
right,
the response I would get personally.
Yeah, but I'm sorry. But,
no, no, go ahead.
But I don't know if you, but I can't guarantee it if your grandparents would feel the same way. So I would feel the same way too. Of course I wouldn't, but I think it's as generational as anything else. I think I can't see, but I'll tell you the truth. Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I think if you went to an Orthodox home in Brooklyn, the Jews, I think they're as hardcore as my grandparents were. They don't change. That sort of right-wing Judaism is the same as right-wing anything else. So,
right.
You know, I think it's nice to know that as Jews, we've at least tried to progress with the rest of the world where we can. But that's very much there, you know?
No, I think that that's very true. And if you went to, I mean, again, you could go anywhere and find anything from 100, 200 years ago. And you just got to look in the right spot or the wrong spot, depending on what your perspective is. It just, it's very, very interesting. And I always look back at the past as, you know, why things were important and how they've evolved. And I think you did a good job painting, you know, sort of how the realities of today's diner, whether it be, you know, health or just dietary preference, veganism, gluten-free, what have you, can play a role in shaping those holiday meals. I mean, again, when I was a kid, you went to a holiday and you were served one thing. And now we go to holidays and there's a fish dish because someone in the family doesn't eat meat. And it's such a small thing, but it's just, it's evolved over time. And I think that these family gatherings is the perfect place for that to really be showcased, is how evolution can occur and how we can change, even though we're still, you know, all believing in the same, you know, big picture, you know, thing. So I want to take this a little bit in a slightly different direction, you know, as we're talking about your Passover meal. How does, you know, I guess, is there something that's served in Passover, maybe not necessarily traditionally on the Seder plate, but something that you would see maybe in your parents' time and maybe that still pops its head up a little bit in modern traditions, that as a chef, and I'm going to go at you now, not as a member of the Jewish faith, but as a chef, what dish could go away? And, you know, the world might be like, okay, you know, it's time. Is there a dish?
Again, I think it's more ingredients that are going away than an actual dish. But I'll give you an example. So yes. So I think side dishes in general have changed. I think side dishes have gone away. When my mother made it, it was a lot of these matzah heavy. We used to take matzah and just substitute matzah for flour. So we'd have matzah rolls, we'd have matzah fritters, we'd have matzah pies, and I think as that has gone away, the dinner itself has become much more simple, getting rid of a lot of those heavy fritter baked, you know, casserole kind of things, and it moved into more simplified. But I think that mirrors culinary. I think that mirrors food in general now. If you think about the evolution of French food, let's say, so the method, you know, when you talk about French food now, it's still there. The richness is still there, but the richness is no longer coming from fat. It's coming from reductions, and so, you know, the tenets or the qualities that make French food what they are, they have to be there to call something classical cuisine. But at the same time, how we make the body or how we make the mouth feel the sensation has changed, along with the times and people's, you know, and globalization has also taken a big part of it too. The idea of you know, another thing to understand about the Jewish faith is that, and it comes back to the food, but Jews can basically, every Jew on earth can basically be labeled as either being Ashkenaz or Sephardic. So the Ashkenaz Jews are the Jews that came from Eastern Europe, white, Poland, Russia, that whole area. That's right, myself, the Ashkenaz. Most Jews in America are Ashkenaz. But the Sephardic Jews are the ones who were the original Jews in the Middle East. Israel, Jordan, that whole area, right? They're darker in skin. They're considered people of color in many ways. And the food changes also, for example. And a lot of it's based on indigenous food products. So, for example, here's something that changed. So when I was a kid, we couldn't eat rice on Passover because rice, if you know anything about rice, rice explodes. You put water into dry rice, and the idea, the reason it doubles is because the water makes the rice grow. And so the rice exploding, or what's the word you want to use, Chef?
It absorbs the water and it expands.
Okay. The fact that rice expands was seen in the Jewish as rising, like a rising loaf of bread. So you couldn't eat rice, the Jews, the Ashkenazi. But the Sephardics did. Why? Because they're from the Middle East. That's all they had over there. So when we were kids, we used to go to Passover. If we went for Passover lunch, because remember, Passover goes all week, and we were pretty hardcore as a kid. We don't do that anymore. At the same time, hold on, you have to remember too, I lived in New York City. Passover schools were closed for Passover, public schools in New York City. So you could stay home. Now schools are not closed for Passover. So I have to come to work and my kids have to go to school. So they have to bring Passover lunches with them to school. So the whole environment of the world has changed to the point where you can't just keep it confined in your house right now. So the food has also become more conducive to the need to go out and live your life globally, right? That's important too. So the Sephardics could eat rice. When we used to go over our friend's house from, I think they were from Sudan or something, somewhere over there, or Jordan or whatever, they'd eat rice. We can never do that. So that's another difference in the foods from something that could go and who couldn't. But now most Jews use rice because it's kind of overlapped. It's like that sort of, you know, the feeling now in the world, and maybe generationally, that it's time to appreciate the past, but let's move on and live our lives, is very much alive in the modern day Seder. Another good example of that is there's a part of the Seder where everyone goes around and reads. The Seder is a very interactive thing, right? Everybody reads a portion of the Seder. And it used to be directly from the Haggadah. The Haggadah is the book that we all use. When you go to a Seder, everyone gets a Haggadah. It's the prayer book that's used. And it's a little pamphlet. It's not like a big, you know, like a Bible or anything, but it's a pamphlet that tells the story of the Seder and it gives the order. By the way, Seder means order. The word Seder means order because there's a strict order in this whole thing. It used to be go around and read the part of the Seder you were asked, right? But now it's become different. Now there are these new modern Seders, modern Haggadahs that have stories of now you tell the things you're grateful for in life and you talk about your own personal afflictions and things. And also, before you get back to the food, the women have been added to the prayers. So instead of, you know, Abraham, Yitzchak, and, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, it's Abraham, and then, you know, Leah, Miriam, Rachel, Rachel, all the, you know, the whole idea of women being brought into, because they were such a major role, they were kept out because of the, you know, the history of masculinity and religion, and now there's more inclusiveness of women. So all those things are changing. You can't really separate the food from these things. But regarding the food, I think, as a chef, what's the best part about being a chef is that we, as a chef, we know the principles of cooking, and therefore we can keep some of the traditional ethos of the meal at the same time using methods and paying attention to wellness that are more common in today's food practice.
So just to piggyback on that, and you talked about as a chef, you know how to sort of bridge, you know, those two, you know, I guess sort of in the idea of rounding this out, I mean, let's talk about a dish that, you know, was not maybe on that initial Passover plate, but you alluded to matzah a lot in this conversation because of its importance. And I think that if you ask anyone, whether they're Jew or not, they're going to say that, you know, matzah ball soup is something that they are familiar with or they've heard of. And it's even something that I cook at my house for my kids because I think it's delicious. I mean, I think it's awesome. What, as a chef, do you do to your matzo ball soup to make it not suck? Like, I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, matzo ball soup is bad, but I'm thinking there are good and bad versions of every dish in the world. And I've had some rough ones and I've had some amazing ones. What is the secret to making great matzo balls?
Okay. So the secret is actually, how do you make great matzo balls while staying within the rules of Passover? Because we know as chefs, there are many ways to leaven a product, to lighten it. And the best matzo balls are those that are fluffy and tasty and big. And they, because, again, the idea of you make the matzo ball mixture, you roll it, you drop it in boiling water. They're dumplings, for essentially, and they rise and they expand again, that whole idea of expansion. But you're allowed to expand food as long as it's done under the rules. So what leavening agents do we use in Passover? Well, a lot of whipped egg whites, a lot of aerating, a lot of ways to make the food naturally expand. What we can't use are any kind of chemical agents. Like, there's no baking soda allowed in Passover, no baking powder. So when you eat matzo ball soup, and remember something too as you say that, matzo ball soup, like bagels, have become two things that have completely become pervasive in the culture of American food. I mean, everybody, you know, you got a family in Midwestern Kentucky buying bagels, and you can eat matzo ball soup when you go to New York City. Any diner you go to, matzo ball soup is a automatic choice for soup. It's like, you know, chowder, chicken soup, or matzo ball soup. So matzo balls and bagels have become two things that everybody knows no matter who they are. If you're making matzo balls, let's say during the year, which many people do, like I told you, well, then the key is easy. You put baking powder into the matzo ball mix, and it comes out nice and big. In the Yiddish word we use, so just to your audience, so Yiddish is a hybrid between German and Hebrew, right? It's, you know, and when Jews talk, they talk in Yiddish. It's like sort of an esoteric slang that we use, you know, wink, wink to each other. It's called pucky, P-U-C-H-Y, something that's pucky. So my grandmother would say, oh, is it pucky? How light is it? How fluffy is it? That's like that's the standard of good food. How pucky is it? So how pucky is my matzo ball. So the puckier or the fluffier the matzo ball comes from the leavening, you know, but in a city you can't do that. So my mother used to use, so when you make matzo ball, you use matzo meal, salt, eggs, and water. That's it, right? But my mother used to take the time to separate the eggs and the egg whites, whip the egg whites. Everything we did in Passover, we would separate those eggs and use the egg whites always incorporated as a folded in to give leavening to. Also, instead of the water, my mother used to use seltzer. Now, scientifically, do we know if the effervescence? I don't know, but whatever it is, I still do it. Is as much as I know the science of food, I still use seltzer. Why? Because it seems like another thing we can add to the cooking process to give it some sort of leavening. So the key again is, how do you use your knowledge in cooking to make the effect without using, you know, products that aren't allowed. But again, let me just repeat, the products that aren't allowed are expanding tremendously. When I was a kid, in my house, you couldn't have anything but regular matzah. Like when you go around now, you know, you see egg matzah, egg and onion matzah, all these different flavored. In my house, zero. My father still won't eat anything but plain matzah, because anything but plain matzah would mean you're enjoying it. And part of the Jewish faith is that if you're enjoying it, you're not remembering and it's not really celebrating. And that's a, you know, a discussion that people have. But I think it's important to understand that there's a difference. The reason that in Easter the eggs are painted and they're rolled, and, you know, the idea of the celebration of, even though this is, you know, Easter is the celebration of Christ coming back. So this is a celebration, right? But Passover is, again, celebrating what we've come from, the pain that we had. So that's really the key. When you talk about food, it's more about, again, like, you come back to the same thing. It's more about keeping the traditions, but in new ways that are more acceptable by people and that are more, you know, that are more globalized.
Right. And I think that, you know, the Easter thing is, you're right. There's definitely more, I don't want to say joy in Easter, but for on the surface, it looks brighter, right? I mean, there's definitely, the food isn't intentionally designed to make you, you know, reflect on suffering. You know, there's painted eggs, there's chocolate bunnies, there's a ton of, you know, there's really very few restrictions on seasonings or ingredients you can use. And, you know, I don't know if that's necessarily just because Catholics don't, you know, want to focus on that. I think that what I've always been told is that the reason that Easter has very few parameters and you can kind of do whatever the hell you want is because you just went through Lent, you know, you just went through giving up something. So you're supposed to be getting back, you know, this idea of a huge feast. And, you know, as someone who doesn't give up anything for Lent, I feel a little bit guilty about eating like my face off at Easter, but like, you know what, as I said, I'm a struggling Catholic. Rob, this was really, this is really informative, and I appreciate you taking the time. And if I can just take a few more seconds to talk to you about something, because and this is, has absolutely nothing to do with Passover or Easter or anything serious, because this year the podcast did a contest in March, basically playing off of the basketball tournament, and ours was called Starch Madness, where we started with 64 different starches. Now, looking at the list that I have in front of me, matzo ball soup, not on there. But we did have a couple of things that, you know, we mentioned on this podcast. There were bagels on here. There's, latkes on here as well. So, you know, we kind of like some of the items we stretched what was truly a starch, but we were trying to have fun with this. And obviously Jamie, who also is a co-host of the podcast, put a lot of desserts on here as well. So we asked people to submit their brackets, and then, you know, Jamie and I also did a bracket and we picked our winners. And so I'm going to have you choose a winner of the two things that Jamie and I came up with. So who won my bracket? Who won Jamie's bracket? And you get to choose. Now, I will tell you that latkes got knocked off in the first round in my bracket, but bagels made it to the final four. So either that is a really good thing or it just speaks to the sort of universal adoption of bagels, as you mentioned earlier, that everyone friggin' loves them. So, and again, there's a lot here that we could maybe you know, do better in future years to make it a little bit more equitable. But the final matchup in the 2022 Starch Madness competition, again, super serious, is cake donuts versus French fries. And I mean, there's no question that I chose fries and Jamie chose cake donuts. That shouldn't influence your decision. But I need you to choose because the winner gets a brand new 8-inch chef knife from Forge the Table, our sponsor. So if you can do us the honor of choosing a winner, and that way it doesn't seem like it's biased, it would be great.
So can I ask, are there criteria? What criteria am I using to choose? Is it my favorite or?
And again, this is where I'm thinking about, okay, this is our first year. How do we do this better next time? Like some of the dishes on here, there was corn tortillas, which of course corn tortillas don't stand up to a cake donut. But if you think about like the possibilities of a corn tortilla, you know, I think that there's a lot more you can do with that. I mean, it speaks to a taco and the taco is like huge. So I think it's really up to your interpretation. What would you say? Like desert island, you get one thing for the rest of your life. Is it French fries or cake donuts?
So I'm going to say French fries. And the reason I'm going to say French fries for a few reasons. I think first of all, it's hard to separate this question from the conversation we just had. So oil is another thing that is central to the Jewish culinary traditions and religions, right? The whole idea of oil and frying things. It comes up in Passover as also latkes you were talking about were fried. I think cake donuts are great. They're very popular, and donuts in general are popular. But cake donuts are also one type of donut. They're sort of, you know, but French fries are in a league of their own. There are entire businesses that have made their names just on how they do their French fries, not necessarily what they put on them or anything, just how they do the actual cut of French fry. If you think about something like the rebirth of Wendy's, right? So Wendy's was Chapter 11. Most people don't know that. And they came back. And when they came back, if you notice, they started making some changes in their food product that emulated sort of this new Five Guys Shake Shack type of this craft burger type of thing. And one of the things they introduced, Wendy's, was the idea of hand-cut fries. So French fries have become such a staple in American cuisine over the years. And French fries themselves have changed. And they're one of those foods that everyone likes at every age. I don't think there's a question between those two. I think if you're talking about starch madness and the criteria is which is the starch that represent all starches, between those two, I think it's clearly French fries.
So I agree. But I also think that, I mean, if cake, there was another, the initial matchup was cake donuts versus yeast donuts, which I would say cake donuts would win that because I think that I like that better. But the...
I don't, by the way. I like yeast donuts.
No, well, and then they, and that's why, you know, that's why we do this. But I think if, like, I'm thinking, like, all right, you're a little bit older in life. You go to your doctor and your doctor's like, listen, you're eating too many donuts and French fries. You got to give up one. What do you give up? Like, I'm giving up donuts. Like, I can live without a donut. Like, fries are... They just, you're right, they are in a league of their own. And I think next year, because they won this year, fries have to go away. I mean, it's almost like an unfair fight. This is the number, they were a number one seed. I mean, they came in, they had a lot of clout, they had Coach K. I mean, they were doing all that stuff, right? They had a big ego behind them. So the 2022 champion is fries. Not surprising, but you know what? They're retiring from the tournament next year. So thanks, Rob, for helping us select that. All right, Rob, thanks again, man. I really appreciate you taking the time talking to us a lot about Passover and the traditional and, you know, sort of modern foods that are now emerging from that. So have a great holiday, my friend, and we'll talk soon.
Same to you, Chef.
Thanks again to Rob Brown for joining us today. And as always, thanks to Matt Burns for doing all the music for the Culinary Now podcast. If you like what you heard today, leave us a review wherever you get your pod and like us on Instagram at Culinary Now Podcast. Also, feel free to send us an email at culinarynowpodcast@gmail.com to let us know what you want to hear about in future episodes. We'll talk to you soon. Bye. We're the brave and the bold.
And we out.